on the average of 4 days a week. A little bit less when I travel, as in last week I was 2 days in Montreal. But I usually try to stay home 1 day a week, sometimes 2 days a week, because otherwise I don't get any research done. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Oh, very good. I may thank you. If I use the computer, it will be after the break, and depending on how the first half goes, I may not use it. So it's not in the room right now. Okay, it's unlikely I would. What I was going to use it for was 5 or 10 minutes of something I can equally well do without it. So if that's a problem for you, we won't use it. Is that fine? Okay, good. So last time was a polemical, hopefully provocative discussion, an introduction to the idea. The ideas of the problem of time in physics and general relativity and cosmology. Today we go in really for the next 4 or 5 lectures to the mechanics of general relativity as a Hamiltonian system. Why do we emphasize Hamiltonian systems? We emphasize Hamiltonian systems because the transition between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics goes through the Hamiltonian formalism. The basic reason for that, among several, is that the dynamics in quantum mechanics is first order in time. There's psi dot, I psi dot is h psi, and in the Hamiltonian mechanics, the dynamics is first order in time. For any observable A, I'll be reviewing this in a minute, we discussed the first time derivative, and it's the result of a Poisson bracket with the time derivative with the observable and the Hamiltonian. I'll be very quickly in a minute reviewing the Hamiltonian formalism, but I assume that everybody here has had it at some point in the past. You may think that you follow Richard Feynman, and that there's a path between classical mechanics and quantum mechanics that goes through the path integral. The integral, say, over fields, e to the I times an action, etc. But anytime you have to answer a detailed question in the path integral approach to quantum mechanics, for example, what's the measure here in the path integral, to find the right answer, you have to go back to the Hamiltonian theory. At least that's the most reliable way to find the right answer. So I take the point of view that to have a solid basis of understanding the relationship between classical and quantum mechanics, we have to go through the Hamiltonian formulation. The Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity used to be ugly and perilous. Since the last 20 years of the Ashtekar, so-called new variables, it's very easy and straightforward. So it's not a difficult thing to learn, and we'll be taking that approach. I could jump right to the quantum mechanics and write down the wave function of the universe, et cetera, and try to talk about the issue of time and cosmology and quantum cosmology. But remember, in this class, we're taking a very critical approach to how the issues arise. So we want to understand what are the issues about the nature of time in classical general relativity, and understand them well in classical general relativity before we go to the quantum theory. So that's what we're going to do the first part of the class. Okay? Now, the subtleties involved in the Hamiltonian or even any formalism of general relativity have to do with diffeomorphism invariance. And so since this will be coming up, let me just make a definition of it, because it's something that I'll use over and over again. These subtleties stymied all attempts to make a quantum theory of gravity or quantum theory of general relativity, of which there were attempts starting already in 1935, and they all tripped over subtleties having to do with the role of diffeomorphism invariants. And these were resolved for the first time satisfactorily by Dirac in the late 1950s. And the key notion, which is the notion today's class is about, is the notion of a constrained Hamiltonian system. And there's a close relationship, I'll be defining what this means, there's a close relationship between these and diffeomorphism invariants, will usually be written diffeo invariants on the blackboard here, and a close relation to gauge invariants as in electromagnetism and Yang-Mills theory. In fact, gauge invariants in electromagnetism and Yang-Mills theory was first really deeply understood, both classically and quantum mechanically, as a result of attempts to quantize general relativity, that is, they were taken, as we will take them here, as model systems. Before anybody studied Yang-Mills theory as a theory of nature, it was a simple example of the issues that arise in general relativity. Okay. So what is the issue? So I'm going to just highlight the issue, and then we're going to start to develop the formalism. So in general relativity, we have a space-time manifold M, and that's a differentiable manifold. It's a infinite set of points, locally in little regions, isomorphic to Rn. That's the definition of a manifold. We will be particularly, because we're interested in Hamiltonian evolution and seeing things evolve in time, we will be particularly interested in manifolds which are the form of some spatial manifold across time, and time is just the real numbers. So we're going to specialize right away. So we're not going to deal with exotic manifolds of different topology. We fixed the topology, and we fixed, and some people will know this rigorously and other people not, we fix what's known as the differential structure. The differential structure is the definition of what an infinitely differentiable function is. So these things come with maps from regions of the manifold to R, and these are functions. So a function on a manifold is a way to associate to every point of the manifold or region of the manifold a real number. Okay. The points in the manifold are called P, and the function gives a real number which at every P, which is F of P. There is a notion in a D, so this will be D plus one dimensional, and the spatial manifold will be D dimensional, and time is one dimensional. And there is a notion of what derivatives of functions are, which I assume you know, so I'm not going to go into detail right now. I will review it just before we actually really use it, but that's not now. And there is a concept of a function which is infinitely differentiable, that is, all infinite of its derivatives are also functions. And what we mean when we say we fix the differential structure is that in every region, in every open set of the manifold, we have an algebra of infinitely differentiable functions, and we can also know how to take their derivatives. Okay, now having said that, there is a map. Consider a map which takes the manifold to itself. I'm going to call the map phi. That is, for every point, say q, it takes you to another point which is called phi acting on q. And it does so in a way which, so this is the definition of a diffeomorphism, okay, on a manifold M. Okay, it's a map from the manifold to itself. The inverse exists, and it takes C infinite functions to C infinite functions. How does it do that? And where is my other blackboard? Okay, we're going to have to get a really tall person, which is almost anybody taller than me. Okay. Ah. Thank you. Great. So we should have, so you should have to be 5'9 or 5'10 to work here. Anyway, functions pull back, so phi of a function acting at some point q is the function at phi inverse at q. So that's how they act on functions. Diffeomorphisms act on functions. Okay. Now, there's a lot to develop, which I'm not going to develop now. Eventually, one goes ahead and one defines metrics on the manifold, connections, other fields, say scalar fields, say psi, on the manifold, and one has equations like the Einstein equations, GAB, which is RAB minus a half, GABR. So these are just by example. There are some field equations. And if you read textbooks, most textbooks in general relativity tell you that a physical spacetime is a manifold, differential structure, which I'm not going to write, and the metric on the manifold, and that's a physical spacetime. And you can find that said in various books, Misner, Thorne, Wheeler, Weinberg, and so forth. But that's not correct. What is correct is that what's a physical spacetime is an equivalence class. So if I write an equivalence class like this, an equivalence class under all the diffeos of the metric and the manifold. More precisely, and I want that upstairs board again, but I'll come over here. There is a group called the diffeomorphism group of the manifold. If you don't know it, I urge you to check while you're bored in this talk that the diffeos form a group. On a manifold, form a group. And what corresponds to a physical spacetime is not a solution of the Einstein equations on a manifold, but an equivalence class of an infinite set of metrics and the manifold equivalent under the action of all the diffeomorphisms on the manifold. Again, I'm not making precise definitions, but I want you to get the flavor of it. And the problem is, the problem that Dirac faced is, what's the real dynamics? What are the laws? Because you see, the problem is, what are the real laws? Because the problem is that the laws are expressed in terms of the metrics, not in terms of the diffeomorphism classes. What are the real laws? What are initial data? If you're going to evolve from one time in the universe to another, then you're used to separating off dynamics into this some set of initial data. But how do you separate out the choice of initial data from the fact that anytime you want, you can knock your metrics in other fields with these diffeomorphisms? So what's the initial data? What are the laws? And what are the observables? And because of that, to answer those problems, Dirac developed the formalism that I'm about to introduce. Okay. Now, there's an analogous issue which is much simpler, which we'll also study. So everybody here knows about electromagnetism. There's the frame, there's the vector potentials. And I'm going to use a four-dimensional formulation. So AA is the vector potential of electromagnetism. If people know what it means, it's a one form. How many people here are comfortable if we use language like one form, two form? Okay, so many people, but not everybody. So the observable fields, however, are the field strengths. And that's because there's a gauge invariance that you can replace the vector potential under by another vector potential A prime, where, let me write this precisely, A prime equals A has the variation. This is the infinitesimal form. And delta A is the derivative of some function. And because the curl of a gradient is zero, under this transformation, the Fs have no variation and are well defined. So one says, one has a situation where the Maxwell equations give dynamics for the vector potentials, but they're ambiguous up to the addition of any scalar field. That's an infinite dimensional group of transformations. Any vector potential has the same physical content as any other vector potential, even though they differ by the gradient of an arbitrary function. So we say that what corresponds to physics, to a physical electromagnetic field, is not the vector potential. It's an equivalence class of all the vector potentials which differ from each other by adding the gradient of a function. So it's the same concept, just like the space-time is an equivalence class of metrics under the diffeomorphisms, which is a huge group of relationships. All these different vector potentials correspond to the same physics, and the way in which we express that and answer these questions, what are the laws, what are the initial data, what are the observables, is we realize that there are some simple functions which are gauge invariant, and we express physics in terms of those gauge invariant functions. And then we write Maxwell's equations in terms of the FAB. Now, that's a case where the answer to these questions is straightforward. And indeed, the significance of the gauge invariance was not understood by Maxwell or by people in the 19th century to work with it. It was only understood first by Hermann Weyl in roughly the 19-teens. Because Hermann Weyl was struggling with related issues in relativity and in unifying relativity and electromagnetism. Okay. Now, there's an intermediate case, which is Yang-Mills theory, which I won't discuss today, but I will discuss, in which you get faked out and you think that that Yang-Mills theory works something like electromagnetism plus a nonlinear version of it. But if you work with it, you see that you cannot avoid the use of the vector potential in writing the field equations for electromagnetism. Okay. So there is questions that were really not understood into the 1970s and 1980s as to what are the real laws, what are the initial data, and what are the observables in Yang-Mills theory. And indeed, the answers to those questions, as I said, were really figured out following this work of Dirac, which I'm just giving a send-up for, as an example for the case of general relativity. Okay? So, one final comment, two final comments. One is that since the diffeomorphisms move points around, fields at points are not observables. Okay. So it really is subtle. What is an observable? You can't say, I want to know the metric is a function of the points, because the points can get moved around and you have an equivalent description. The other thing is I nowhere mention coordinates. If you look back over what I said, I did nowhere mention coordinate systems, and I nowhere mentioned invariance under changes of coordinate systems. There's a lot of confusion in the literature caused by people who thought that what this was about was the invariance of the Einstein equations under changing the coordinates. And we could have a long discussion if we were scholars as to whether Einstein was confused himself about that, but certainly others like Kretschmann at Einstein's time were confused about that. Okay. I nowhere mentioned coordinates, and diffeomorphisms are not changes of coordinates. They're maps that send points of the manifold to other points of the manifold and functions on them to other functions. Okay. And we'll see that when we start to work with this stuff, we'll be always very careful. We may sometimes have to choose coordinates, but we'll be very careful to separate out issues of coordinates, general coordinate invariance and so forth, from issues of diffeomorphism, because there's a whole graveyard of confusion about that issue. And the way not to be confused about it is to only introduce coordinates at the end of all your considerations and calculations. This is the sort of and for you younger people, this may not be such a surprise, but I went to graduate school in the period of the transition, so like Steve Weinberg still thought that everything had to do with coordinates and coordinate invariance. And if you look at his book, there's no mention of diffeomorphisms in it. It's all about coordinates. I mean, he's nonetheless a great physicist. And Misner, Thorne, and Wheeler, and books that follow, Walls and so forth, and all the books that follow that, were the first physicists who were not confused about this issue. Now, there's a claim that Einstein himself was not really confused, but we'll get to that. Yeah.
Should essentially from inside the manifold define and map one point to other point, or it can be between two manifolds?
It can be between two manifolds. Thank you for mentioning that, but I don't need it here. Okay. So let me get started on the development. Okay. So we're going to consider a system of particles in Rn. So actually, I'm going to call it Rd. And I'm going to have n particles. And they are going, so with there's no diffeomorphism invariance, so Rd is Rd. It's d copies of the real line. Okay, and a position in Rd is given by xA, where A is 1 to D. And that denotes a position in Rd. And since Rd really is D copies of the real line, one knows what that means. There's no issue of diffeomorphism invariance. And there are I particles. There are n particles, so there's a coordinate I equals 1 to n. There is also going to be a time parameter S, and so a history of the system is going to be given by functions n times d functions, sorry, of S. Okay? And we want laws that determine those histories. Okay. And there will be two cases regarding whether there is invariance under changes of the parameter S or not, but we'll come to that in a little while. Okay? The dynamics is specified by an action, which is an integral ds of a Lagrangian, which is a function, and if you will, I know this is horrible for those of you taking notes, but let me replace the x's with q's because that's more conventional. And the Lagrangians are, in the cases we'll consider, are functions of the q's and functions of their time derivative. There are cases where the Lagrangian is a function of higher than one time derivative, and we're not going to discuss those now. But what we're saying naturally extends to that. The dynamics is given by varying s equals zero. The first variation of this is zero, subject to boundary conditions. So there is some s. So x at some s initial is fixed, and some x at some s final is fixed. Okay. Otherwise, there is no good solution to the variational problem. Q, thank you. Thank you. Okay, and I think that everybody here knows that you get the Euler-Lagrange equations, which are the d by ds, delta s, delta q dot, ai minus delta s, delta q, ai equals zero, are consequences of the variation, of the vanishing of the first variation. Okay, so that's ordinary Lagrangian mechanics. The idea of Hamiltonian mechanics, so, and this is typically a second order system in time. This typically, these Euler-Lagrange equations have second order time derivative, second time derivative. And the idea of the Hamiltonian approach, which was apparently due to Lagrange and vice versa or something, is to replace it with a set of first order equations. And the way one does that is one introduces momenta, PAI of S, which is delta S, delta Q dot. Notice, okay, and that's the definition of the momenta. And then this becomes an equation that says P dot AI is delta S, delta Q AI, which is a first order equation. And this typically is another first order equation. In typical systems, this is proportional to the velocity itself. So these are first order equations. The momentum is proportional to the velocity. And the derivative of the momentum is some function of position. Notice something. I'm pretty careless, but one of the things that I try to be very careful about is positioning of indices. And there are two things that are going to really matter in discussing both classical and quantum dynamics on manifolds, which we have to do with general relativity. One of them is being careful about indices. So upper indices are vectors. Lower indices are one-forms. And indeed, the momenta is a vector. I'm sorry, the momenta is a one-form, and the positions are vectors. And I will always, if I ever miss that up, catch me up. The other thing which we'll get to, we won't be talking about it right now, is being careful about densities and who is a density and who is not. And so we'll have to pay. Otherwise, you can make lots of mistakes. Okay, so the idea is to introduce an object called the Hamiltonian, which is a function of q and p, which is p q dot minus l of q and q dot. And the equations of motion which follow from the same variational principle. That is, the variational principle is now delta of still the action, so delta of the integral ds of p q dot minus h of q and p. So we rewrite the same variational equations. And I hope this is review. I hope I'm not going to ask. Good. Okay. Let me find my eraser. There is a neat trick, possibly invented by Poisson, which is to define the Poisson bracket of two functions of q and p. As the variation of A del Q AI, the variation of B del P I minus the reverse A exchange with B. By the way, notice something, because I'm careful about indices, there that PQ dot is a sum over upper and lower indices. Here, there is a sum of upper and lower indices. If I ever have to do anything other than pair an upper and a lower indice, that is, do a contraction of a vector with a form, I will explicitly write down the metric and involve the metric. I will never write something like q dot a, like that, because hidden in that is a metric. And since the metric is going to become quantum mechanical and quantum gravity, you need to always have it displayed explicitly. So if you're used to writing q dot a like that, then get out of the habit. Okay? Every time I sum over indices, it will be a raised and it will be a raised and lowered pair. So it will be a vector and a one form. Okay? And then the same equations we have up there are equivalent to a dot is the Poisson bracket of A with H. And this is equivalent to the Euler-Lagrange equation. In particular, Q dot is delta H delta T, and a variation by a one form is a vector, and P dot, and there's a reason I'm going through writing equations that you know already, delta minus delta H delta Q. Okay, so that's the Hamiltonian formulation, and I assume that everybody has seen it. Now, the greatness of Dirac's quantization, and it is in that little book, so let me mention again, please order that little book if you want. It's $3 used or $7 new, a Dover reprint. The Dirac's lectures on quantum mechanics from 1964. What he understood is that when there is a gauge invariance or a diffeomorphism invariance, this procedure has to be modified. Why does it have to be modified? It has to be modified because the evolution equations, let's just look at the Maxwell equations. The evolution equations are not deterministic on the degrees of freedom that they're written down on. If you write the Maxwell's equations for the vector potential, they look different in different gauges. And so there's an ambiguity. If I give you initial data, there's an ambiguity for how I evolve it, depending, quote, on what gauge I'm in. And what that means is that there's an ambiguity in the Euler-Lagrange equations because there's a freedom as we evolve to make gauge transformations as we evolve. It's not just that you can add the derivative of a function. You can add the derivative of a function which changes in time as you're evolving. So Maxwell's equations on the vector potentials, which I'm not writing down for the moment, are not deterministic. If you try to treat it like a mechanical system and give initial data and evolve the equations, they're non-deterministic. They are deterministic on gauge invariant quantities, but they're not deterministic on gauge dependent quantities. And because of that, these equations require modification. And Dirac realized exactly where the modification had to be. And what I'm going to do is take you through it in generality, which for those of you who haven't seen it before may be a little bit of a stretch, so trust me for 15 minutes. And we're going to do the general case first, and then we're going to do three examples. Okay? So, if you like, this is a discussion of what can go wrong in the transition from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian picture that you have here in front of you. So what can go wrong? The scene of the crime is in the definition of the momentum. Sometimes this equation, now normally, let's make a little sidebar here. Normally, the Lagrangian is a half Q dot A, Q dot B, the metric GAB minus some potential, which is a function of Q. And this says that P is proportional to Q dot, as we said. Okay, if you really want it right, there's the metric stays around there. So normally you have PAI is the metric GAB Q dot AI. Okay? Sorry, B. But sometimes that's not the case. Sometimes this equation is just this side is zero. So for example, there are cases where Q17 has no time derivative. There's no time derivative in Lagrangian. So consider a Lagrangian where the Lagrangian is like this, and then it's also a function of Q17. Okay, but there's no time derivative anywhere, then P17 is zero. What that means is that you can't actually, if you go back through the variational principle, where you replace the Euler-Lagrange equations with that variational principle at the bottom I'm pointing to, there's something that doesn't work. The demonstration that H is just a function of Q and P doesn't go through, and the fact that the variation as a variation of Q and P rather than Q and Q dot doesn't go through. And I'm not going to show that to you, but you can check it out and we'll see that in examples. So in this case, we're left just with an embarrassment. We can't complete the transition to the Hamiltonian picture. Other cases can happen that P17 is just, 17 is the most random number, it's just the name for one of them. This might be some function of the Q's and the P's. But there's no time derivative anywhere. Another way to say it, I said it in too mysterious a way, when you write H is PQ dot minus L, okay. Look, what you do is you invert this relation and you write Q dot is proportional to P and you plug in, so you have PQ dot and you invert this to write Q dot is some matrix times P and then PQ dot becomes some matrix PP. And then you have the Hamiltonian is just a function of P and not Q dot. When you have something where there's no Q dot, in the equation, you can't invert and find Q dot completely as a function of P. You can't find Q dot as a function of P, and then you're stuck. And you cannot write the Hamiltonian as a function only of P. And so that's what goes wrong. And we'll see this go wrong in specific examples, including just the free particle propagating and this example of electromagnetism. So just trust me that this goes wrong. The question is, what do you do when it goes wrong? And Dirac's insight is that then you have a constraint. That is, then there's, I'm going to call this constraint pi. Then you have some function of q and p, which is zero, with no q dot anywhere, by virtue of the definition of the momentum. And these things are actually called primary constraints. That's the technical term for them. So when, in the definition of momenta, you'd find some functions of q and p with no q dots, okay, that's called a primary constraint. And Dirac's insight is the following. So let's draw a picture. So this is phase space is the space of the q's and the p's. It's 2 times d plus n-dimensional manifold. And what's happened is that by the very definition of the momenta, there's some surface here which is defined by the constraint. Pi of q and p is equal to zero. And the system has to be on that surface by definition, because that function equals zero arises from the very definition of the momenta. And this is called a constraint surface. And the idea is that when this is true, you can invert the velocity of the momenta. You can't invert the velocity of the momenta on the whole phase space, on the whole space of p's and q's, because the definition of the p's requires that you be on the surface. So you can only invert to find the definition to invert to get rid of the q dots on this surface. And that means the variational principle that you should do is delta of p, I'm dropping indices, of p q dot minus h of p and q plus a Lagrange multiplier times this constraint. And if you do this variational principle, sorry, there's an integral in time, then the variation of, let me call this thing S prime. The variation of S prime by that Lagrange multiplier gives you the constraint. So this insists that you're on that surface, and then you can invert and get rid of the q dot here. Now, what I'm not proving these, but these are easily checked assertions. Okay, and again, we'll see these work out in examples. Okay, is it clear what I'm asserting? Okay. So, and this Lagrange multiplier is a free function. So it's as if there's a new Hamiltonian, which is the original Hamiltonian, plus lambda times the constraint. And what we should be doing is evolving with this new Hamiltonian. And if we evolve with this new Hamiltonian, it will automatically take care of the constraint. So it will automatically be on the surface. In particular, if we start somewhere on the surface, if we start off the surface again, the whole thing falls apart. It's inconsistent. If we start on the surface and we use this new Hamiltonian, the fact that lambda is arbitrary and we treat it like a degree of freedom, which means it's varied as well, means that we'll always be imposing the constraint, means however we evolve, we'll always stay on the surface. Okay, so changing the Hamiltonian by adding the constraint times the free Lagrange multiplier means that we always stay on the surface. But now there's a free function. in the dynamics. Now when we write down, you know, Q dot is the Poisson bracket of Q with H prime, is going to be what it used to be, the Poisson bracket of Q with the original Hamiltonian, plus this free function, this times the Poisson bracket of Q with the constraint. And this is the freedom to make gauge transformations, I hope to convince you by the end of today. That is what I hope to convince you of, is that every time there's an ambiguity in the evolution because of the freedom to make a gauge transformation or the freedom to make a diffeomorphism, there appears in the Hamiltonian a free function, which dynamics does not determine. And that is multiplied by a constraint. And what that means is that the constraint, and this is a lot to absorb, so we're going to see it in three examples. The constraint is doing two things. It's keeping you on the surface where the dynamics is consistent, and it's also telling you that there's a freedom to change Q by an amount which is an arbitrary function times the Poisson bracket with the constraint. So the constraint is giving you the arbitrariness in the theory. And we'll see that this constraint actually make gauge transformations happen. They have a dual role. They keep you on the Q's and P's where the theory is consistent, and they also tell you the freedom of gauge transformation. Okay. Now, let me just say one more thing, and then we'll start looking at examples. Okay, but any questions? Yeah, let me do the guy in the back.
Maybe it's a daft question. Does it ever happen the other way around? Is that there's no constraints in the cotangent form, but there's constraints in the formulation?
I don't know. It's the same thing. Yeah?
I can understand what happens when you go from the surface, from that surface to the other part of the free space.
We'll see. Let me what I hope I convinced you of is that you have to be here because this function pi is equal to zero is constant, the definition of the momentum. So there are no momenta in the theory that correspond to any Q and Q dot that are not on the surface. To show you that actually the dynamics is inconsistent if you try to start from somewhere off the surface, that's later. Okay, I haven't shown you that.
Okay. The one more thing is that we have to worry about, we're not necessarily done yet. I'm going to do an example where we are done, but just to give you a preview, the last thing that we have to worry about is we have to worry that the constraint also stays zero. That is, if you start zero, and you evolve, it stays zero. And so we have to consider how it evolves under time, and that is gotten by taking the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian, and we use this Hamiltonian H prime, okay? And this thing had better be zero. And if it's not zero, we have to make it zero. Okay? So one thing that can happen, I'm not going to give you, Dirac in the book does the whole classification of the eight different things that can happen. One thing that can happen is that you get another function here. Another function of Q and T. And you have to set this function to zero, because if you don't set this function to zero, the constraint will not stay zero. So you have to set this function to zero. And that is, you have to go back and add another Lagrange multiplier times this new function. So you can, and these are called secondary constraints. As constraints that arise from preserving other constraints. And so there's a whole beautiful classification of what can happen. You can do it again, and you have to do it again, and you have to do it again, and so forth. And I'm going to skip that and tell you some examples. Okay? So any questions up to here? In the first example, we'll have to do one iteration of it. Yes?
Of the constraints of first division and first manifold not be like a subset of the boundary of the whole manifold?
It's just the way you've drawn.
We are not carefully discussing boundary conditions now. When we discuss boundary conditions, the constraints, the constraints have to go into a boundary. Let's worry about that in the real case. Okay. So I want to start by talking about a case everybody knows. Okay, which is the free relativistic particle. Okay? And this is a particle, so one particle, so it's a simple case. Let's do it in 3+1 dimensional space-time, so we know everything. Okay? And there is an energy momentum vector PA, which is EPI. So I equals 1, 2, 3. A is 0, the time coordinate, and I. And the one thing that we know about this is the energy momentum relation. So the energy momentum relation says E squared is equal to P squared plus M squared. And I will work in units where the speed of light is equal to 1. Okay? Now, how is this relevant to our this conversation? This Lorentz invariance, but it's not relevant because of Lorentz invariance. It's relevant because I want to write this in a way that is where the solutions are histories, X of S, where S is reparameterization variant. That is, I have in space-time some particle moving. I have some label, which is the label. But notice, there's already an x0 coordinate, you know, and an x1 coordinate, an x2 coordinate. So we already have a time coordinate, which is x0. Which has the usual special relativistic time coordinate. Okay? So this is just a parameter, the parameter along the curve. And to bring that out, I'm going to want to write the dynamics. The dynamics shouldn't matter if I take the time parameter and I map it to some other time parameter, which is some function of the first time parameter. It shouldn't matter, because what physically you want to measure is what is, say, x1 when x0 is equal to 17. x0 is what's measuring your clock and your frame of reference. That's what you want to know, is where is the x-coordinate when the clock and your frame of reference is reading something. That's physically meaningful. The parameter along the curve should not be physically meaningful. Okay. So we try to write the dynamics in a form where we can make, this is called a reparameterization. And we require only that this change is monotonic. That is, that it doesn't start, it's always increasing. And we want to write the dynamics in a form that's reparameterization invariant. And this is because the parameter has no physical meaning. What's nice about it for us is it makes it a little laboratory for exploring the issue of diffeomorphism invariance. Because basically, what's happening is the time parameter is on the real line, and this function is a diffeomorphism which is taking the real line to itself. So this is a simple example of the issue that we're interested in. if you like. In general relativity, their coordinates are meaningless. There's an arbitrariness of the coordinates. This is, as I made a speech, not the same issue, but in case you like to think about coordinates. And a toy issue is just making a theory where the time parameter is irrelevant. You can use any time parameter at all, just like you can use any coordinate system in general relativity. So that's the motivation. So how do we do this? How we do it is we jump and we write an action. This may not be the first action that's written down in textbooks, but we write an action for the particle, which is, no, it's not, which is integral of the time parameter of t x dot. I'm going to comment on that in a little bit. And here I should put minus the Hamiltonian. And what am I going to pick for the Hamiltonian? I'm going to pick for the Hamiltonian a Lagrange multiplier times a constraint. And this constraint is just the function of zero on this. So it's e squared minus t squared minus m squared, or in relativistic notation, where the metric is plus, minus, 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 it is a to ab, ta, pb, minus m squared. And now, that's not the way that the relativistic particle is usually presented in the textbooks. But as I'm going to explain, it serves as an example of this formalism, which is very transparent. And we'll get back the usual dynamics that you're used to just in a few steps. Let me remark, I should prove the reparametrization invariance. So let me notice that under S goes to S prime, which is F of S, ds goes to ds prime, which is F prime ds. P of S goes to P of F of S. Q of S goes to Q of F of S. That is, P of S and P of F of S refer to the momenta before and after we make this map of the time coordinates. Okay. And we would like, and we notice something, notice that because there's a time derivative here, just look at this term. There's an integral ds dxa ds pa, just to turn it around. So the ds here cancels the ds here. And indeed, under a time reparametrization, this goes to ds prime times f prime inverse times dx ds prime times f prime. So the f primes cancel, and that's the way that you demonstrate that that term is invariant under reparametrization invariant. That is, I'm really showing you that this is, that the action is left alone by this. Okay. Now, if P and Q change, we say this, they change as scalars, there's no derivative in the change, then H, which is just a quadratic function of the P's, changes just as a scalar. So that means that the lambda has to change. So lambda of S has to go to lambda of S prime, which is lambda of S times f prime. So it has to, in other words, lambda transforms like dx dS. And I hope I have my f primes upwards rather than backwards. But of course, you will tell me if I make any mistakes. So the d by ds here transforms to cancel the ds here, and similarly in this term, lambda has to transform. And what a fancy way to say that is that lambda is not a function. Lambda is a density on the real line. And remember, density is something that you can integrate. Okay. So if I have lambda transform this way, then under a reparameterization, s goes to the same thing, ds prime, of the same quantities, and is left invariant. Okay. Any questions about that? For people who have seen this before, I apologize, I'm going slowly, but I hope I'm going slowly enough for the people who have not seen this before. Because every one of these details matters, and this is a simple example. And these are the kind of, and I told you we would have to get straight when there's a density, and when things transform like a density. The point is that when the metric is not fixed, you have to remember your basic calculus, and remember that what you integrate are densities. And h is a function of the real number. So you can't integrate it. So you have to multiply it by a density before you integrate it. X dot is a density. That's why you can integrate it. You have to get out of the habit of thinking that every time there's an integral, there's really secretly an integral, you know, square root of the determinant of the metric that's secretly there that you never write that makes sense of your integrals. And so most, you know, physicists who don't do general relativity are in the habit of just forgetting that you integrate densities, you don't integrate functions. And you just integrate functions left and right. But functions cannot be integrated, only densities. Okay? There was a reason why you took calculus. Okay. Now, let's apply Dirac's scheme to this simple example. The first step is to find momenta. And I've done that for you. Delta S, delta Q dot. A is indeed the momenta, and it's correctly labeled. But there are other degrees of freedom. There's the lambda, and the lambda is a free degree of freedom. So there is the momenta of lambda, which is the variation by the time derivative of lambda. And what's that? Just to see if everybody's following. What's the momentum associated with the quantity lambda? Zero. Because there is no derivative, time derivative of the quantity lambda, and therefore that's a constraint. That constraint, we'll call it pi, says that p lambda is equal to zero. And this first thing is its definition. Okay? So that means that the Hamiltonian is pq dot minus the Lagrangian. Okay? And that, if we work it out, is lambda times the constraint. This constraint, And we should add to that, so that's H0, and but we should really be studying H prime, which is H0 plus some other Lagrange multiplier, we'll call it lambda prime, times T lambda. And so altogether, H prime, what we should use as the Hamiltonian, is lambda times this constraint H, plus another one, lambda prime, times T lambda. Okay? So our constraint surface just says pi lambda is zero. So far. Okay? Now, I said we have to make sure that the constraint itself is preserved in time. So we should check that the constraint pi dot is zero, and that's the Poisson bracket of pi, which is really T lambda, I'll go ahead and put it in, of P lambda with H prime, and is that zero? Yes? Well, no. Because there's a lambda here.
The lambda, Poisson bracket P lambda, is not zero. Sorry, I forgot to say that. I thought that was implicit.
Q A and PB as Poisson bracket delta AB, and lambda and P lambda as Poisson bracket 1. That's what it means to say that P lambda is the momenta of lambda. So this P lambda hits the lambda and the Poisson bracket, and the result is you get a minus H. So the theory, the consistency, that is, we only stay on the surface where lambda has no momenta if H is zero. Now, I set it up because I wanted it to come out that way. H is equal to zero is the energy-momentum relation, E squared is T squared plus M squared. So I set it up so that this would happen. Okay? So we have to add another constraint. So we have this constraint, and we have another constraint, but we already have a name for it, okay, H. So we have this constraint, which is eta AB PA PB minus M squared. So that's the second constraint. So now our constraint surface is even narrower. I won't draw it again, but it consists of these two constraints. And that one was boring, that pi lambda is zero was boring, because you didn't even think pi lambda was part of the theory. Okay? But this is a quadratic equation. So this says now we have a quadratic surface in the phase space we have to be on. And being on that surface is just satisfying the energy-momentum relation. Well, we better do that again. One more time. Let's make sure that H is preserved in time. So we take the Poisson bracket. Now, first, we should add this new constraint to the Hamiltonian, but it's already there. We don't have to add it, but if it wasn't already there, we would have to add it. It's already there, so we don't add it. But we have to make sure that H has zero Poisson bracket with the whole Hamiltonian, and we have to check. Well, does H commute with lambda? Yes, because there's no P lambda in it. Does it commute with itself? Yes, the Poisson bracket is anti-symmetric, so it commutes with itself. Does it commute with this? Well, this is a free function, so yes, it commutes with that. And does it commute with P lambda? Yes, because there's no lambda in it. Okay, so we're done. So the result is that the Hamiltonian of the system is this one in the box. And notice that there's something weird about that. Oh, good. Okay, so I get my two blackboards here. Well, actually, before I push it up, notice this is something about it weird, which is that H prime is zero. The Hamiltonian is zero. Okay, why is that? Is that general? Hold that thought, okay? Just hold that. We're going to see other examples. Okay? And just think about why is it that H turned out to be, H prime, which is the real Hamiltonian of the system, turned out to be zero. Now, we can ask, let's look at the evolution of various quantities. So, for example, let's take Pa dot. That's the Poisson bracket of Pa with H prime. Okay. And what's that? Well, that's zero. And in fact, I'm going to note over on the side that the Poisson bracket of P with script H, the constraint, is zero. This is zero. And this tells us that the p's are conserved quantities. So you already knew this. This is the free relativistic particles. You already knew that the p's were conserved quantities. So the momentum and the energy are conserved quantities. What about x? Q. So let's take the Poisson bracket of q with H, let's do separately space and time. Qi with H is, and let's get the signs right. Oh, they're over there. It's minus. It's minus Pa, Pi, and minus, and there's a 2 lambda there. And there's actually the Minkowski metric is sitting in here, if I really want to say it precisely. Eta ij. But that just is minus 2 lambda times pj times pi. And q0h is the same calculation, but the sign is different, is minus 2 lambda P0, I'm sorry, plus 2 lambda P0, which is 2 lambda E. So that tells us that Q dot I is minus 2 lambda PI, and Q0 dot is 2 lambda E, the energy. Okay, so we have evolution in space and time. We have some conserved quantities. I made a mistake somewhere, and somewhere there is a sign mistake. So I'm just going to take lambda negative from now on. Okay, I apologize for that. And why don't you notice what happens if I integrate these equations. If I integrate these equations, I get qi as a function of s is minus 2 lambda times s times pi plus some constant of integration ai, and similarly q0 of s is 2 lambda s e plus A0 should be upstairs. And so we just have linear propagation. Yes?
It's on the right. Do you mean H, sort of normal H prime rather than the constraint?
Here I mean the constraint H. Oh, so I'm sorry. The lambda should not be there. All right, thank you so much. The lambda comes here, but it's not there. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. And I want to do one more step, which is I want to solve for 2 lambda s. So 2 lambda s is q0 minus a0, the initial position, over e. And therefore, I can write qi as a function of q0. Remember I said that that's what we're really interested in. And that's pi minus, pi over e times q0 minus a0. Plus AI.
Okay. So finally I get what's just the linear motion of a free particle. Okay, not a big deal. This was an easy example. Let me talk some language. Okay. We have here an analogy to gauge transformation. Under these, and let's think of these like gauge transformations. That is, if I give you 2 histories of the system, 2 trajectories, q spatial and q time as a function of s, let's say they describe the same physical system. If under the math, from s goes to another s prime, which is a function of s, I take the 2 trajectories to each other. So I use the same language. The physical trajectory is an equivalence class of functions QA of S. The changes within the equivalence class are given by H. H is a constraint. But when I act by H, okay, what I'm actually just doing is telling me how the functions Q and T change as a function of changing the time parameter. This is not evolution. These equations in this box tell me how the Qs and the Ts change under changes of the time parameter. Just under changing S to S prime. It's not evolution. Evolution is given by the total Hamiltonian H prime. These guys are evolution, and they differ, as you pointed out by mistake. These have the lambda in it. The lambda tells me what are the units, how fast is time progressing. If, depending on the derivative of lambda, is time going fast or slow, the coordinate time. Okay. Now, as I said, we're not really interested in the q's as a function of s. We're interested in the correlation. What is qx, qy, and qz when q0 is some certain amount? And we work that out. These are what's observable. And there's no time parameter in them. Okay. Now, in fact, these functions you can check. These functions out here commute, so these qi defined that way is a function of the value q0. That is, it answers the question, what's the x, y, and z coordinate when the q0 coordinate is something. These commute with the Hamiltonian constraint. And in the class, I'm going to be giving various exercises. That's a good check. Check that. That's an invariant quantity. It's gauge invariant. It doesn't have the time parameter in it, and therefore it's physically meaningful. Okay? So this is the way you use Dirac's formalism. Okay, any questions? I can add, of course, almost everything on the board. We had another constraint, the P lambda, and almost everything commutes with that except for something that depends on lambda. That's also more gauge. That's the gauge to change lambda. So there's two arbitrarinesses. One is the arbitrariness in the choice of lambda, which tells you sort of what rate is your time coordinate evolving, and the other is they're related, and we could go into how they're related, and the other is the explicit change of the time coordinate. Okay. So this is a little toy example, but these same steps come in to electromagnetism, to Yang-Mills theory, to general relativity, to string theory, to all the theories of interest, and we're going to go through them and see how this language and this technology works. What you have at the end is you have some dynamics living in this constrained surface, and that's the physical dynamics. And that's what you take over to the quantum mechanics. And we'll be discussing, not today, but we'll be discussing when we've done some examples, how you take this kind of classical mechanics on a constrained surface over the quantum mechanics. Okay, questions?
Okay, let's take a break. Let's come back in 15 minutes, and
then we'll do two more examples.